A huge mass of garbage and plastic debris is floating around in the central North Pacific Ocean. Some scientists think it's one of the most pressing environmental disasters we now face. And joining me now to talk about what's being called the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is Dr. Marcus Erickson of the Algalita Marine Research Foundation. He sailed from California to Hawaii this past summer on a raft called Junk, made out of 15,000 plastic bottles, in order to call attention to the problem. Welcome to today's Underreported.
Thank you for having me.
First, can you tell us about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch? How big is it?
Well, it actually occupies the entire North Pacific Gyre. There are five subtropical gyres in the world: the North Pacific, South Pacific, North Atlantic, South Atlantic, and Indian Ocean. And these are swirling masses of water. So the North Pacific Gyre, it begins about 500 miles off of California's coast, and it goes all the way to 200 miles off Japan's coast. So it's like a giant toilet bowl, never flushes. It's rotating currents going in a clockwise manner, and it's full of particles of plastic. What we call the Eastern Garbage Patch is the eastern edge of this massive gyre, where we've been to already six times, and we go back and forth skimming the surface to monitor how much plastic debris is accumulating.
So the garbage gets caught in this swirl.
Exactly.
Is there a similar garbage patch in the Atlantic Ocean or the Indian Ocean?
Well, we assume so because we find plastic debris washing up on distant shores around the world. But, for example, the North Atlantic Gyre was studied most recently was 35 years ago, and no one's been anywhere else except for the North Pacific, where we have been six times over the last decade.
And what's in this garbage patch? Is this just stuff that people have thrown off of ships?
Well, it's the plastic that floats. Half of plastic produced actually sinks, like polycarbonate, and you'll find that in our nearshore environment, lakes and rivers. But what floats goes out to sea. What we're finding is mostly trash that leaves our coastal watersheds. It's things like plastic bottles and plastic bags and broken buckets and utensils, things that in our throwaway society we lose much of it out to sea. Now, there's also some from the fishing industry. Like, for example, less than a year ago, we were 2,000 miles out to sea, and we found this 3-ton mass of tangled fishing nets. So we guess about 20% comes from the fishing industry. The rest comes from the entire Pacific Rim, just contributing trash from their coasts.
So if someone in, say, Seattle drops a plastic bottle into a sewer, what's the likelihood that it would end up as part of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch?
Well, if no one recovers it along the way, it's going to ride oceanic currents, and then it may get washed up on some other shore along the coast. But if it gets caught up into the gyre, into that rotating mass of water, North Pacific, it's there potentially forever. Plastics were designed to be non-biodegradable, to last forever, and they do just that. So that plastic bottle cap leaving Seattle, if it goes down storm drains, doesn't get captured there, goes down rivers through Puget Sound out into the sea, if it catches into that gyre current, it'll be in Japan in about 5 years if it doesn't hit Hawaii, and it'll come back to the coast of North America 5 years after that.
But this is more
keep on going.
This is more like having something swirl in the toilet as it's being flushed, rather than a kind of a floating island.
Correct. It's just plastic debris. It isn't static out there. It is moving about. It's seasonal, the way the gyre moves, and it's always going in this very slow little clockwise rotation. In our area, the Eastern Garbage Patch, we have gone back and forth the last 10 years. We began in 1999, and when we went there, we found that by skimming the ocean surface, that the mass of plastic was six times heavier than the mass of zooplankton. There was this huge ratio of plastic versus any available food for filter feeders.
When you say you're skimming, yes. If you were just sailing out there, if I were on a cruise ship, would I say, oh, gee, we've gone into the garbage patch, or would I just see water as I have seen when I've gone out to sea at other occasions?
you might see a few particles here and there, and you really don't see it until you begin to skim the surface. And we use a real fine mesh net. I mean, the holes in our net are smaller than the holes in your T-shirt. And we're catching lots of zooplankton and lots of small particles. I'd say that the best analogy for the density, imagine a whole football field with one handful of cornflakes distributed over the whole area. So you don't really, you don't arrive into this plastic island. It's this very distributed particulate of plastic debris. Now you do find the big stuff. You do find these massive tangled balls of fishing nets and fishing gear. And you'll find an occasional bucket. You'll find bottles and you'll find plastic bags every once in a while. But most of it breaks down by UV light into smaller, still plastic little fragments.
And you say that the same sort of thing is probably happening in the Atlantic Ocean, except that we haven't investigated it?
We assume so. In the North Atlantic, it was looked at 35 years ago, and even then, they were finding plastic particles. Now, I even read an article when Thor Heyerdahl had crossed the North Atlantic, and he observed plastics back in his day. So we assume it's there. We have yet to go and quantify it now, which we hope to do this year, actually.
My guest is Dr. Marcus Erickson of the Algalita Marine Research Foundation. We're talking about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. When was it discovered? You mentioned Thor Heyerdahl mentioning it, but I assume that it wasn't as big then as it is now. It probably was just some garbage that had been caught up in the currents.
Sure. If you look at the plastic production in the United States, in the last 20 years, it's almost a vertical curve, and that's because of single-use disposables. We produce so much plastic now in our throwaway society, but we have seen the rate of accumulation in the North Pacific Gyre almost parallels that rate of production. So in the last 10, 15 years, we have seen much more plastic growing in the North Pacific. Now, it was studied off the Japan coast about 20 years ago by a fellow last name Day, and he found some plastics. But just in the last 10 years, our foundation, we sailed from California to Hawaii, and we found the plastics, and we kept on going back year after year, just recently, about 11 months ago.
Has more and more of it been washing up on our beaches?
Yes, more on our beaches. More is accumulating and staying in the Pacific garbage patch. In fact, in the last 10 years, it has doubled. And it's in the last few years, it's becoming more of a human health issue as we find plastics impacting many organisms. For example, 44% of the world's seabirds have been found with plastics in or around their bodies. Also, 22 whale species, all marine sea turtles, and countless fish have been found with plastics in or around their bodies. In fact, this summer when I did my rafting trip across the sea, I found one fish, a little rainbow runner. I caught it as we were running out of food. I fished it. I filleted it to eat it, opened its stomach on a whim, and found it was full of plastic particles.
But I would imagine that some marine life might thrive on it if it harbors certain algae. The algae might provide food for sea life, wouldn't it?
I guess it may. I mean, if filter feeders are filtering out seawater and they're consuming plastics, they may be able to digest what's on the outside of plastics. But we're finding is that what makes it a human health issue is that these plastics are also harboring other kinds of chemicals. There are many hydrophobic pollutants like DDT, PCBs, other organochlorides, PAHs from fossil fuels, oil drops from cars. You find all these compounds in the marine environment. They don't mix with water, but they stick to plastics. There's one scientist in Japan, Dr. Takata, he found that one plastic particle of the size of a lentil can have up to 1 million times more of these pollutants than ambient seawater. So we're finding that animals are consuming these plastics that serve as these pollution sponges.
And that fish that you caught, could you have just cleaned it out and eaten it anyway?
Well, what's interesting, the latest research, what's happening now, our research question now is to find out when animals consume plastics, do they desorb those toxins from the plastic into their bodies? And the answer for a few organisms is yes. Like PCBs, for example, are transported from plastics that birds are eating like cigarette lighters in the stomachs of Laysan albatross, the PCBs go from the plastics into those birds' livers and other organs and fat tissues. Also, some benthic worms can transport other toxins from plastics into their tissues as they consume sediment and invariably consume some plastics. So what we don't want to see happen is plastics serve as a medium for many pollutants to enter the food chain, get stored in their tissues, bioaccumulate up the food chain into the food that we as humans harvest from the sea.
Haven't turtles mistaken plastic bags for jellyfish and then ended up dying from malnutrition because their digestive systems are lined with plastic?
Well, what I've seen happen in many sea turtles, there are a few sort of popular photographs of turtles with bags out of their mouths. Often what happens is the bags, they get stuck in their intestines, and I've seen photographs of turtles with the bags sticking out the other end. In fact, just a couple weeks ago, 2 months ago, I went to New Orleans, and I found a turtle belonged to a friend of mine that had walked into a milk jug ring when it was a hatchling. And it got stuck in this ring, and as the turtle grew, it wasn't able to break that ring. So this now it's a foot diameter turtle that has a waist that's 2 inches in diameter from being stuck in this ring. So plastics are impacting a lot of organisms, and now ourselves.
Is any of the garbage hazardous waste?
I haven't seen any hazardous waste. No, not per se. Except for example, some cigarette lighters you'll find with fuel still inside them, inside the stomachs of some birds.
Because we've had incidents in New York where hypodermic needles have washed up on shore.
Yes, biohazards, yes. And in fact, I have another friend, Dr. Heidi Allman, who lived on Midway Atoll for several years, and she found a few cases of Laysan albatross with syringes in their bodies. In one case, the needle sticking out the bird's chest.
So does all of the plastic that we've been talking about affect the chemistry of the ocean? Will it give the oceans a different consistency?
At least on the surface, yes. What happens to plastics at sea, it doesn't biodegrade, but it does photodegrade. But the plastic isn't breaking down. It's breaking apart. So the basic plastic polymer, that long hydrocarbon chain, is extremely stable. What the sun does, it'll break those polymers from each other. So what we're turning the ocean surface into is this plastic soup, where you have, I guess the soup is the best analogy. Imagine the noodles of a soup being all this fishing line, the fishing that we find out there. The meat of the soup, or the veggies of the soup, being the larger plastic, like milk crates and jugs and bottle caps. But the broth of the soup is all these plastic polymers that are now distributed worldwide that are making up the micro layer on the ocean surface.
I've read that the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is helping scientists to measure how long it takes to make a lap around the Pacific subarctic gyre, and it's giving more information about variations in water temperature and salinity. So is there a positive side to this story?
Well, I guess the positive side is that we are able to draw some information from the transport. Yes, like you said, there's a fellow named Jim Ingram, worked with NOAA, did a 20-year study. He released buoys, tracking buoys, off the coast of North America and Japan, and found that it was a 10-mile round trip for a plastic bottle cap to go from Seattle or San Francisco or L.A. to Japan and back. So there are these modeling studies by using plastics, and there's also the famous story of rubber duckies being lost at sea and being washed up around the world, and through that, finding new ways that plastics can travel, riding these unknown currents.
Well, this is a modern version of the old note in a bottle, isn't it? You toss the bottle into the ocean and say, please rescue me, and then you wait 10 years for somebody to come by.
You know, I did that on my plastic raft. I had a bottle of wine, a glass bottle, that I used a cork and put a message in there and toss it overboard as we were out to sea for a couple of months, ran out of food. We put our message in the bottle.
And did it ever come back to you?
I'm not sure. We'll see if the message comes back. I think I put a few dollars in the bottle along with a letter saying, please mail this back to me someday, whoever gets it, on some distant island.
Tell me a bit about your raft, the junk. 15,000 plastic water bottles?
Yes.
You didn't fish them out of the ocean, did you?
No, we didn't. We... we came back from our recent gyre expedition about 11 months ago in February of last year, and we had this sense of urgency. Having seen the accumulation of plastics double in 10 years, we thought one major solution is to legislate to stop the use of single-use disposables. It makes no sense that we use a product designed to last forever and then make products from it that are designed to be thrown away, like bottles and bags. So we thought the one way that we can promote this legislative efforts is to raise awareness, public awareness. So we built a raft out of the same junk which we were trying to ban. So we took 15,000 plastic bottles. We took derelict fishing nets and made these 30-foot-long pontoons. On top of that, we took 24 old sailboat masts, made a deck, and for a cabin, we wanted something watertight and lightweight. Went to the most amazing junkyard in Southern California and got an airplane. And we tied all this stuff together, an airplane, the mast, the bottles, and on June 1st, we just sort of threw ourselves to the wind in Long Beach, California.
Did you have separate sleeping quarters and a mess hall and all the other comforts of home?
No, we did not at all. It was just myself and a co-navigator, Joel Paschal, an experienced sailor, just he and I alone, on this homemade raft, living out of an airplane for a total of 88 days.
Although you had to assure yourself that it would be seaworthy, didn't you?
Well, not exactly. I've had experience building plastic boats in the past for the education work that I've done. We began sinking in the first week. What we didn't realize was that we use these Nalgene bottles, sports bottles. The netting was twisting the caps off the bottles. So after a few days at sea, we had 2,000 bottles that were full of water. So we spent the first month at sea actually making our boat seaworthy by gluing the caps back on and emptying bottles out. That was the first month.
You maintained a blog along the way, and we have a link to it posted on our show page at WNYC.org. So you had some pretty advanced technology along the way. How do you get internet access in the middle of the Pacific Ocean?
Well, we had a great sponsor, was Explorer Satellite. They gave us what we needed. I have my own computer, and we would hook up a satellite phone to my computer, and I could send low-resolution photographs and short videos I was editing while I was at sea, send those via satellite to my fiance, who was also a partner in this expedition. She was back home. She ran the blog. So I was able to post within a couple hours, like video clips of fish I was catching, storms we were experiencing, what it was like being at sea. We actually dragged a net. We trawled the ocean surface. We were able to show this along the way. We had a pretty good following. I mean, our purpose was to get the public's awareness of our research and what we're doing. We had about 250,000 blog hits, about 32,000 the day we arrived in Waikiki, 88 days after we started.
And what did you eat along the way? If you were fishing, weren't you worried that a lot of the fish would turn out to have plastic inside them?
Well, we only caught about 16 fish total. I was amazed that there weren't as many fish as I expected. Actually, I met a fellow the day before I left who had done the same thing in 1958. His name is Don McFarland, and he and three guys, they built a 9-ton wooden box and made it to Waikiki from L.A. in 69 days. It took us 88 days on a much more high-tech raft, I thought. But he said he was finding that they saw sharks every day. They can catch tuna every day. We saw one shark, one 2-foot shark. We saw no tuna. And he was telling me he could sieve the ocean surface for plankton to make some soup. Every time we did that, there was far more plastic than plankton. So I can say, I can conclude that, I mean, from my experience, if you're lost at sea, you know, you can't count on the ocean's bounty to sustain you.
Now, can we clean this up? Most of the approaches have been recycling and the bigger, better bottle bill, for example. We have all sorts of programs here in New York City. But is there a way of going into this big patch and just sucking up as much of it as we can?
Well, I think we have to consider the scale. I go back to the analogy of a handful of cornflakes, plastic cornflakes, over a football field. There are over 9 million football fields in the North Pacific alone. And to extract all that plastic without extracting all the organisms that are there, is a near impossible task. I don't think there's a techno fix for this issue. I think what's going to work is a cultural fix to get ourselves off of disposable plastics. And like I said, it's irresponsible to take a material designed to last forever, then make products designed to be thrown away.
Dr. Marcus Erickson of the Algalita Marine Research Foundation, we have posted a link to the Junk Raft blog as well as to the Algalita Marine Research Foundation. If you want to see photos and learn more about the problem, you can check it out on our show page at WNYC.org. Any more trips in the offing?
We're going to Atlantic Gyre, the Sargasso Sea, in December of this year.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Take care.